Greetings. You're listening to the podcast with a K, in which 40-something male, pale and stale anoraks chat largely about Doctor Who, a show they've no professional experience of, but have nevertheless spent a large chunk of four decades watching. I'm Christian Corley, a man who plays with phones for money. This week I'm joined by the ever-indecisive James McLean and Swiss transatlantic man about suburbs, Brian Terranova. Hello, chaps.
Hello.
Morning.
Hello, first of all. Secondly, we're going to be talking about Nikola Tesla's Night of Terror in this week's podcast. But before we do that, we are recording this on Monday, the 20th of January. It's Tom Baker's birthday.
So it is.
Today, he's 86 years young. Which I think is quite nice.
Well, I mean, absolutely.
Yeah.
So a big happy birthday to Tom Baker, because I think maybe for many of us, Tom Baker's reason why we're still Doctor Who fans, or why we became Doctor Who fans, certainly for me, a major part of it, if not the entire part of it. And then there's Brian. Do you remember many years ago Tom Baker did a campaign for British Telecom in the UK for BT?
Yes.
And some listeners may recall this. And James may even recall this. He did, you would like send a text message to someone. I think that's how he did it. And then he would read out the text message to the recipient. And obviously it required Tom Baker to sit reading out various words. And then they were all like, you know, digitized and put in a database and, you know, cross-matched and everything for the message to be sent. And it resulted in us, me, making some amusing jingles using the real voice of the real Tom Baker many, many, many years ago, which I might see if I can dig one up for the end of the podcast.
Yeah. Why not?
Sounds like a bit of fun. So, guys, have a good weekend.
I'm technically still in my weekend with my work schedule. So, you know, it's going well. I'm getting to talk to you two today about Doctor Who. So, you know, that's a good start to a weekend Monday.
Yeah, that's, I mean, you're boxing my head with the whole idea of weekend Monday there, I have to
yeah.
say.
Yeah, I might do something.
Yeah, yeah. It's supposedly Blue Monday today, but I mean, I've never got that. So,
what does that mean?
It's supposedly based on studies and a large amount of promotional money from a particular organization 10, 15 years ago, the day of the year that's most depressing or the most difficult to get started or whatever. But I don't really buy that because I've done absolutely tons today. So,
yeah, I've been productive too.
Yeah, so I'm not entirely, you know, a lot of these things are a bit of that and a bit of promotion. So, pinch of salt, really, pinch of salt. Now, before we get into the business side of this week's podcast with a K, I was given an email, or sent an email, because no one gives emails. I sent an email.
No one sends emails.
That's, well, a certain type of person sends emails. This one is from Paul Millington, the media and online officer from the National Space Centre, and he got in touch to tell us about The Science of the Time Lords, which is an exhibition taking place this weekend on the 25th and 26th of January at the National Space Centre. And on Saturday, visitors can meet special guest David Bradley, the second First Doctor, the third, the fourth, the First Doctor actor.
Yeah.
And there's lots of stuff going on. There's photo shoots and stuff going on throughout the days. There is also the TARDIS interior, which will be there, which was built as part of a 48-hour challenge in 2019. So there's an opportunity for photo shoots. And there is the Hyde fundraisers there with their monstrous collection of characters as well. So there's lots of stuff going on there. So I would urge anyone interested to head over to spacecentre.co.uk with haste, as it is this weekend, and tickets may not be there later on. Basic prices are £15.50 for adults and £12.50 for children and
concessions. Where is
it? That's the
Where is
National.
It?
Yeah, that's the.
Yeah,
that's the
I know that.
Centre in Leicester.
Spatially. Leicester.
Yes.
Okay.
Leicester. So yeah, sorry. Leicester. I thought I mentioned Leicester. Sorry.
No, that's all right.
Yeah, so you'd need to be in Leicester for that.
So he's the fourth First Doctor.
Is he the fourth First Doctor? I lose count of First Doctor.
Well, it depends. I mean, if you include Cushing and you've then got Herdnall as well.
Are we counting the dummy first doctor in the chase?
Okay, then the fifth first doctor. Then. Yeah. I don't know if we can really, because then do you have to cancel like Stuart Fell for the fourth doctor?
Do you have to count Peter Purvis as the first doctor as well?
Okay.
Yeah, it just starts getting tricky, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, yeah.
What is the first doctor? That's what we have to decide first, don't we? Is it the actor? Is it the persona? Is it the voice? Is it the body? Yeah.
Is it the face? Just the face?
Yeah. Is it just the face? You know, where is that? Where is the heart? What is it? A matrixy of the doctor, the first doctor? I don't know.
That's quite.
I mean,
deep.
Is he different? Is he different if he's in the comic? You know, when he's there with his nephew and niece or whatever. Is he? Is that a different doctor again?
Not about that one.
Is it? Yeah. Is this too early? Is this too early for you, Brian?
It's a tad too early for my brain. Yeah, I'm trying to keep up with all these first doctors. You know, I was only told that you had one chance to make your first impression, but apparently that's not true of the first doctor.
I mean, if you've got an annual like you did. And every artist tends to draw him wrong. Are they different incarnations of the first Doctor as well? Are they like different characters playing it? Are they different continuities? I mean, you've got recently the finishing of the USS DC's Infinite Crisis Earth sort of thing. And you've got these multiple worlds being played out into their sort of intertextual crossover stuff. And it's like, is this the same here? Are these different infinite versions of the first Doctor? Badly drawn first doctor, you know, 80s Hurdnell first doctor. Doctor.
It's possibly a conversation for a completely different podcast.
Absolutely.
Yes, there's definitely something in that.
I mean, it's the John Guiler first doctor and Day of the Doctor. Is that like an alternative one which slipped through the net? And the first Doctor Hartnell one was just not quite there yet. He was a little bit behind. Which would be very much in character, because he doesn't know how to fly the thing. So he would hardly appear in Day of the Doctor, would he? He would land somewhere else by mistake.
Plot hole alert. Yeah.
Unless he did accidentally land there by mistake, and that was the precedent for knowing how to do the whole thing first, you know. It depends on how you want to play it.
No, you're absolutely right. When you consider it like that and recontextualize everything, then, you know, you've got at least four doctors who are unlikely to have made it.
Yeah. Absolutely. I suppose they would be drawn there in the same way they're drawn into every collaborative Doctor episode.
Yeah.
Something draws them there. I'm sure we can justify it because it is but fairy tale make-believe.
Indeed. And speaking of fairy tale make-believe, I mean, there is a business side of this, and the overnights haven't been great for this series of Doctor Who so far, and there is a tweet gone up from a journalist Nigel Pawley today, who says Doctor Who's ratings decline a big worry for BBC bosses despite being sandwiched. Now this is the thing for me: despite being sandwiched between rating hits Countryfile and Call the Midwife, it managed just over 4 million viewers, over 1 million down on both shows. Now they may be ratings hits, but then again, if it's 1 million down on both shows, then they're only pulling in 5 million. So there's that. There's also the fact that neither of those are anything that you could describe as family viewing. So, you know, Countryfile's quite niche in some ways still, even though it's moved from its old niche farmer slot on a Sunday morning. And Call the Midwife is a little bit more adult for most family audiences, which makes you wonder. You know, in that context, I've never really given it much thought because of the iPlayer effect. I usually watch it on iPlayer. Why did they put Doctor Who between those two programs?
I think it's just simply because it's the Sunday drama slot, isn't it? And that they've been pushing. But I think the bigger question here is why journalism is being, well, I don't know whether they're being narrow-minded, but I don't think they're really trying to understand that, as we've said before and recently, the changing nature of television. What sort of people watch certain types of show. Now, Countryfile is not a show which tends to have an audience which might be split across a variety of different VOD online methods of watching television. Mm. It's a show which will situate itself as a terrestrial thing that the people who watch it will probably most likely be predominantly terrestrial watchers. People who watch Doctor Who, not only have you got the factors we've said before, you've got it's now displaced through things like iPlayer, which has a high turnover of people watching it through that, including myself. But more importantly, you've also got, for the type of people who watch Doctor Who, you've got a far busier, cluttered market to detract from Doctor Who's prominence, which is not a good thing. But I don't think it's about necessarily to say about the quality of the show, or the show's quality has changed any difference to Capaldi or Smith particularly. I still think it is essentially the same things we're getting. It's just we have a market now where it's like, well, are people going to be more likely watching The Witcher? Or are the people more likely going to be watching episodes of Star Trek gearing up for Picard? You know, it's a different world for the same sort of people who'd be watching it. So again, we come back to that question we had a few weeks ago. It's like, does Doctor Who need to decide what it actually is and who it's aimed at so it can consolidate where it's going? So I think the journalism at the moment, a lot of the fans, the way they talk about it, it's almost either deliberate or just missing the point that Doctor Who especially is an extremely complex demographic to analyze compared to other shows, like you say, which have very different demographics and very different ways of people watching it and very different competitions to what people would be watching if they're not watching that. So I think it's about trying to remind journalists and fans that this is a really complex question. I don't know what the answer is, but how we analyze how well it's doing is going to be really difficult at the moment because it is now changed so much in the last, even the last year to the last 3 years. So even by the time Capaldi was around, the landscape is now different again. So we can't even really compare it to his figures. So I don't know what we compare it to.
Maybe we just need to decide whether we like it. Completely, you know, changed in that respect, which I do agree. You were saying like it was sandwiched in between two odd shows, but isn't it kind of more important not what it's sandwiched in between, but what it's up against? Like here on a Sunday, what is it playing against on other channels? Because that would be the bigger detractor than what it's sandwiched in between.
It is our version of Dancing with the Stars. Ice Dancing with the Stars. Dancing on ice.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. Ice skating.
How but did then that there do is also... in ratings?
Better.
Okay, well.
Maybe. I haven't got but all the figures in front of me. But
you've got the question that people watching Dancing with the Stars and Countryfile are more likely, I would say, and this is just a subjective guess, more likely to be watching BBC on linear television than fans who watch Doctor Who or people who tend to watch the sort of shows like Doctor Who. So they are naturally going to gravitate to having a more of an audience pull. And to Brian's point about what's there before and after, there is that question of flow where people do tend to sort of carry on watching if something ends and if something doesn't sort of naturally dovetail, then they're not going to stay with the channel. They're going to channel swap, which has been an argument that's been going around for, 30, 40 years. But I think that's also a factor why, in theory, we'd be looking at what's before and after as well as what's against. But then, like I say, we're no longer in that situation where we've got channels, where people are watching channels anyway. And they're just as likely halfway through to start watching, you know, the Titans on their iPlayer, on their phone or on their tablet. So... Yeah, it's a mess.
Yeah, it is. And it's, as you said, it's very difficult to work out what's what and where it's going to go and where it's in short term, where it's been. Which brings us to Nikola Tesla's Night of Terror, which excitingly started mid-story for the Doctor and gave us a nice kind of pre-credit sequence in which the Doctor and crew run into Nikola Tesla and Thomas Edison and... Queen Scythra. Now, I enjoyed listening to last week's podcast with a K. I'm unable to make it as I was, as my children were singing at a big choir thing in Sheffield, which had Tony Hadley at it from Spandau Ballet. So it was an interesting experience listening to the show and also listening to, because the previous night, my twins were at a dance competition, which one of them won a trophy at. And I missed the episode as well. And then listening to your podcast, I decided I wasn't going to watch it.
Oh, dear.
Which, I may change my mind. It wasn't just the podcast. It was also the comments on Facebook and comments elsewhere. So also, I dare say...
But our other regular sort of person
Mr.
here...
Cavana.
Mr. Cavanaugh was very pro that episode and really, really enjoyed it. So it's a kind of a shame he wasn't there as well to
give his view.
I mean, I think with someone like Gareth, and it's hard saying this without him being present, Gareth has a very strong, gets a lot of pleasure from certain eras of television, which I think you could argue this one was quite reflective of. It has a bit of that sort of season 24 feel. You could imagine it in McCoy, not far off Delta and the Bannermen or Dragonfire, and maybe a little bit of a kitsch sort of simplicity of a Graham Williams era, which again is one of his loves. So I think if you're into those kind of elements and you don't mind them being sort of revisited in a contemporary television show, I could see why he enjoyed it and why others might find that jarring or just not what they want in what they're watching now. But maybe he needs to come on and say, yeah.
Well, he probably will at some point. Now, with the reflections of my colleagues on last week's podcast in mind, I'm interested to see how they feel about Nikolai Terror's Native Chair, which I think is an absolutely fantastic title, by the way. I will give my thoughts a little bit later as they're raised. But guys, after last week, how is this? Brian?
Me, okay. I thought it was an improvement over last week myself. Not without issues, though, obviously. I thought the story was nicer. I thought the story worked better. I thought the flow of the story sort of worked better. Characters were played a little bit more straight, which was nice. Some things I wasn't so keen on was that the TARDIS played a big factor in the resolution of the story. I kind of think when you land, the TARDIS should be the object that gets you to and from the story. It shouldn't really be part of the story unless somehow it's a major part of the story. It shouldn't just be like there to be used as a tool, I guess. But I don't know. I liked it better this week. I thought it was a much better story. It was more entertaining, maybe a little bit slower paced, again, back to the series 11 issue that I had. But on a whole, I enjoyed it more.
What about you, James?
I think it was, I think it was a lot more confident and coherent. I think it was very much Doctor Who. I think there was actually someone in one of the comments, which I'm sure we'll probably get to on the Facebook page, which sort of said, like, they were going through it and then they were going, oh, my God, this feels like Doctor Who. And I kind of felt like that. And I've not felt like that in years. Now, at the same time, I wasn't massively engaged. And I think that's because I've seen this sort of thing quite a lot now in my time. And maybe it just didn't really speak to me, but it did feel like it was speaking to what the show's about. And certainly for audiences, which I think Doctor Who should be primarily there for, which aren't, as I've said before, old men who have been watching it for decades. I think this was a good. I think it was a good story. I think it used it used an interesting historical character. I think it was well acted. I thought it looked good as well. I thought it was fun. It sort of had a pacing of a Doctor Who episode. It felt very much like something I could imagine either on a Big Finish or a sort of 1980s Davison era. It sort of had that sort of mixture of the use of historical characters, the ridiculousness of the plot, and the sort of kind of back and froing the Doctor Who sometimes does. And that sort of end bit with them sort of trapped at the very end in a sort of siege moment, that felt very much like the old show as well. So I think there's a lot of trappings there which really spoke to what Doctor Who is. I can't pretend that I wasn't massively engaged, though. And I think, as I say, that's probably more about me than it is about the show. And acknowledging the show can't always be delivering what I want, which is probably something a little more challenging and fresh. But I think this is by no means, does not speak to what Doctor Who's always been about.
Yeah, I would agree largely with that. I very rarely touch my phone when I'm watching Doctor Who, in contrast to things like, say, Midsummer Murders or NCIS or those types of shows. I will often look at my phone to check who actor A is or if they've been in that show before or whatever. Whereas Doctor Who, I don't tend to do that, although I did last night, and normally I would just wait till later on. So maybe there's a little bit of an engagement thing there. The direction I felt was very kind of Davis era. It was like something Eris Lynn might have directed, or even Graham Harper. It was very fast paced, I thought, specifically for the action sequences. Obviously, there were pacing issues elsewhere in the episode, but the actual action sequences did feel kind of a little bit kind of modern classic. Just a reference to the casting. Goran Visnjic was Nikola Tesla. Goran Visnjic, known for ER and various other things. Robert Glenister was Thomas Edison. Robert Glenister is obviously a big part of the Cadence of Androzani story from 1984. And he's also brother of Robert Glenister. Anjali Mohindra was Queen Scythra. Anjali Mohindra.
Philip Glenister. Played...
Yeah, did I say Robert Glenister is Robert Glenister's brother?
Yeah, he can't be brother to himself.
Depends not how unless he enjoys his spare time.
So he's the second first Glenister. Yes. We carry on.
One of them is Celatine, and the other one is the android Celatine. Obviously, Christ.
So he's the third. Third Glenister. Third Doctor Who. Glenister. Carry on.
And Anjali Mohindra was Rani in the Sarah Jane Adventures.
Yes.
And she Queen Scythra. Now, Hayley McGee was Dorothy Scout, but no one seems to have heard of her, according to Wikipedia. Now, the thing there's something about this episode that I liked a lot, and that is Robert Glenister. I thought it was absolutely bang on. And I feel that he was playing a sort of Donald Trump without being an Alec Baldwin Alec Trump. Donald Trump, you know what I mean? He was playing a hard-nosed businessman, and he was, you know, he was playing it in that sense. And I think it was in contrast to that guy who played the American in the Spiders episode in series 11, yeah. Which was difficult to take seriously. But Glenister being perhaps a more intense actor, maybe did this with the grace that it required, I think. And whether that was in the character or not, who knows? But we know from history that Edison was primarily a businessman rather than a dreamer, as Tesla was more along the lines of. And I think that gave the episode a good grounding, because it you could hang off that and the rivalry between them, which we know was real. And if you didn't know it was real, then it was, and you do now because you've watched the episode. So for me, that little moment of checking the cast aside, I thought it was a really good episode. Obviously not having the Orphan 55 quote dip that you guys have had, it just felt like a continuation of the previous two episodes for me.
Mm. Yeah, I think that.
Sad when you go back.
I think, to be honest, I think you'll find it all right. I think it's one of those things that when it's your first watch and your hopes are high, and then you watch Orphan and you feel a bit, I imagine if you're watching with your hopes low, you'll probably find it's not as painful as it probably sounds.
You've uttered the magic words already, which is season 24. So.
Yeah, but then, you know, Delta and the Bannerman season 24, and I think most of us agree that that's kind of fun. And I think it was trying to be fun, but. Yeah,
I think there's a difference, though, where that story, you know, at least had some sort of cohesion and felt like it was going somewhere and working, where this one felt like it just failed every mark for me. So I personally disagree with James. I think going in with low expectations is just going to make you sit there and go, well, thank God I did that.
But then even with Delta, but if Delta and the Bannermen was played out now, would we be saying similar sort of things that, you know, the fact that two of them shoot off on a spacecraft at the end, you know, with the babies a bit weird? And do you know what I mean?
Delta and the Bannermen was made in the 1980s, back when stories were very differently told on TV then. We've evolved from that time now. So you can't tell that again and make it work. If you do, it's undoubtedly going to be like a Hercules TV show or Xena or one of those terrible TV shows they play on the CW here in America. Even the Legion of Superheroes or whatever that thing is that DC is doing right now. Though, like, it's one of those shows where you know that it's being made as a budget TV show with very poor writing. I personally think we should be expecting more from Doctor Who right now than retreading old ground like that. And I don't even think if that story aired in season 24, it would have been as enjoyable, because it still would have been, what are they doing? What is, none of this is making sense. And we had some of those in the past before, and we talk about them with Time Lash and so on. You know, like, there are stories in the past that, even though they were made in that era, still don't even make sense in that era. And I think that this one is just one of those ones that isn't ever going to stand the test of time. In my opinion, I just, the more I think about the story, I don't really find anything enjoyable about it outside of the visuals.
Okay.
Last week's story, that is.
Yeah. Okay. So this episode, Nikola Tesla's Night of Terror. I think maybe, I mean, it's not entirely a success. There are some weaknesses. I've heard some criticism of Anjali Mahindra as Queen Scythra. And we saw in the trailer prior to season 12 that there was a Rachnos-style creature in the episode. So maybe that's part of the negative comparisons. I don't know. How do you think she did? Because that's not an easy job, isn't it? Wearing all that gunk on your face, wearing that great headdress, and then the rest of her was like, looked like to be a very static costume with a bit of CGI at the back.
I thought she was great.
Yeah.
I thought she was great all the way through. I thought she was over the top. She was fun. We complain that we don't really ever have any antagonists in Doctor Who in the last few years, and here you have an antagonist. Yeah. She's a small fish in a lot of ways. But I think that was a bit fresh as well, that she wasn't, you know, something which was hideously dangerous to the world, to the universe. But she was a sort of a bunch of pirates, essentially, that just needed to be stopped. She gave it character. She was well far away from her old work in the Rani. So she, in Rani, should I say. She, I think she did a great job of giving the show a bit of colour. And yeah, a bit of ham. But again, I think to some degree, you know, Doctor Who is an over-the-top concept. I think you can get away with that and have a bit of fun with it. Maybe the show's been lacking a little bit of that fun in its enemies, aside from that one, which is the Master, or Missy, which is allowed to be. But every other antagonist is normally quite dull. So, yeah, I welcome that. I thought that was good. I thought Goran Visnjic, I can't say his, I actually no idea. I've never heard his name pronounced before.
Goran.
I think he's working in Timeless. I've seen him in Timeless. I thought he was really good in that show as well. I thought he played very convincingly, and Tesla came across as quite charming and quite a sad and imperfect character.
Do you know what? I think 20 years ago, or 25 years, what year are we now? 25, 30 years ago, with that portrayal, you could have, you know, Doctor Who fans would have been saying, we want him for the Doctor.
Yeah, quite probably. I think a lot of it worked. I think the problem with the Scythra was, again, the same problem as we have last week, is that there's just no real signature to them to create the fear. They don't ever really attack anyone apart from with guns, and occasionally she flashes her tail a bit. So there's never any real feeling of their threat as they should have. And while they look great as irritable scorpions running around the place, because they don't ever do anything, again, that limits their threat, the same as we had last week, same as we had with Vampire in Venice. Mm-hmm. You need to show something a little more immediate with what they are and who they are. And I think guns is a bit dull.
Could the episode have benefited from more of a base under siege with the, you know, the scorpions actually being there in more greater numbers earlier on, do you think?
I think they should have used the tails. I think those tails could have just, you know, pierced their cloak, and that's how they killed people, and would just appear like it sort of kind of did for her. I think they needed some signature which would make people go, oh, that they sting people, or, oh, you know, there's something that's a little more visceral than just a gun, which is invariably what they were using most of the time.
Yeah.
And if, like last week, if that is a too scary idea for TV, the same with the arachnids in the UK, where you don't really see them do anything either, then maybe they shouldn't be in the show if you can't utilize them properly. You need to have
visuals rather than scary effects.
Yeah, well, you need to, because I just didn't feel like there was any real threat for them from them. Maybe a kid would. I thought they were creepy as scorpions, But I didn't feel like there was anything there that made me worry that they, because all they were just people with guns.
Yeah.
Most of the time. And that to me is the problem. We see people with guns all the time. And yes, it's a threat, but it's a very bland threat. And it doesn't really escape from the fact that we've seen people escape through trains many times. We've seen people uncouple trains to escape from villains every time. Yeah. So
the Silurian gun the Silurian gun there is clearly to sort of like give you an early warning into the idea. Chekhov's Silurian gun, maybe.
Yeah.
They're pirates and they're using other people's technology. Whereas really the green thing is kind of a part of that because they're chasing the green thing. So maybe they could have avoided that and just had like a mysterious death by this fleeting glimpse of a tail, as you say. One thing I did think was a little bit wrong, it might be our resolution. We may not have been watching in HD. We may have been watching standard BBC. Or then again, it was an iPlayer and I don't know how you switch between that or not. But I digress. The scorpions, when you saw them in the spacecraft, I thought they were a lot smaller than they were when they materialized on Earth, which was kind of a nice surprise to see that actually they're absolutely massive. But look, seeing them in the spacecraft moving around, I got like
the when perception. When they're higher, though.
Yes, but I'm not sure if the correct kind of depth
you
of field
feel,
is there.
Yeah.
No. Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough.
What do you think of the scorpions, Brian?
No, I can agree with you. I didn't think that they were as large in the ship. I also felt it was odd that they were very scorpion-like and the queen was humanoid-like. I thought there should have been more of a gel between the two, I guess. I thought her portrayal was fine. I actually liked the fact that it was very similar to the Rachnos, not just in appearance, but in portrayal. I don't know if that was her choice or the director's choice or whatever, but it kind of made it seem like, yes, we get that these are similar and there's a reason. You know, I can imagine they're from the same planet kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite things actually was when they first started attacking New York and like two of them ran into each other and one knocked the other one over. I thought that was pretty nice touch on the CGI rather than just focusing on them running around and attacking people, gave them kind of more reality to them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they should have killed more people, though. You didn't even have to have them on screen. You could just have them running into buildings and hearing the screams off screen or whatever.
Should have happened for sure.
Made a bigger deal of their threat. But yeah, I like them. I like them. I'd like to see them again, actually.
Yeah, because I think again they're not just like, as I say, you know, the Daleks, Cybermen, or the big leagues tend to be, as we've talked about this before, tend to be monsters in the monster type. They're either things which are dominating and taking over the world, or they're things which are trying to take you over. But this was something a little fresher, wasn't it? It was just a band of annoying pirates. But annoying pirates in enough sufficient quantities can be a threat. You don't have to have it being a global threat. You can have a small village, and you're protecting a village from a threat, and that's still a threat. It doesn't have to be taking over the world. So. Yeah, I think it just adds another layer, another level of threat as well.
Well, how and cool does scorpion pirate sound, anyway?
Yes.
You know, there's also another connection when you think about it that I find interesting. Like, I loved the idea that they were basically scavengers, that they didn't have their own technology. They were just stealing other people's technology and using it for their own. And that's that's an idea that was first, to my knowledge, at least my experience, I first saw in an episode of Star Trek. And I like that. I like that concept that rather than them being like intelligent enough to make their own, they make others do for them. But it even harkens back to the Runaway Bride, where the Rachnos had the pilot fish, the scavengers. Mm-hmm. And at first, like in the first episode, Christmas Invasion, we were meant to think they were, you know, separate. They were there as a separate entity, which seemingly they were. They were just trying to like pick on the scraps kind of thing. But in the Runaway Bride, they were working for the Rachnos, and we know that they're scavengers. We know what they do. And now it makes you wonder about her web ship. Like, clearly she was able to create her ship, but how much of that technology within the ship is truly hers is now something that's running through my head. And whether or not that's important, it truly doesn't matter. But it's an interesting thing to postulate now that they may be truly that connected, and that their race may not have been capable of getting themselves off their own planet in the first place. It's a neat callback, anyway.
Yeah, I like that.
I like that. Yeah. I liked I mean, again, we'll probably talk about this when we go through the Facebook comments, but one of the things which I see quite a lot coming up is, and it's this term which seems to be floating more and more frequently, this play school doctor, which interesting really does also date the type of person who doesn't like the doctor for this reason. She's too much like she's from play school. And I was thinking, I can kind of understand that. She's very light in this episode. And I think, yes, I like with Matt Smith, I far prefer Matt Smith later on, where he's a little more mixed and a little less just superficial as he is in the first couple of seasons.
Yeah, I agree with that.
But I can see as a kid that being quite engaging, because I think when I was a kid, and I loved Davison because, as we've said this before, I know, he was someone that I would like to hang out with. And I think that's kind of good with the Jodie one as well. I think for kids watching this from 6 to 12, 13, she might be someone they would want to hang out with, that they would feel comfortable with, that would feel a fun. And I think while it doesn't necessarily, again, it's not necessarily giving me what I want, which is something more darker and deeper and complex, I can understand why for younger audiences, again, that's actually probably quite a good match, rather than the sort of brusqueness of a Capaldi. This is something a little more friendly. And I remember when I was a kid, I liked the friendly. I liked feeling assured by having a lead, a protagonist who I felt assured and comfortable with, that I trusted.
Yeah.
While obviously with Capaldi, you didn't always totally trust him, even later on, because he was a little more of a complex and darker character.
I think you're probably right, yeah.
Children.
Well, yeah. I'm not sure. I don't think the tone is quite right in that regard. When people speak of a female doctor, someone like Catherine Tate or Jennifer Saunders, or not necessarily someone older, but someone who feels a little bit more capable of doing weighty stuff as well as light stuff, whereas Jodie stuff seems to be very much light and not quite as light. The whole explainer thing, there's a show on CBeebies, and there's a YouTube channel as well, hosted by the same lady called Maddie Moat. The show on CBBC is called CBeebies, big fan. It's called Do You Know? And it's basically, it's a science program for kids that's on at like 4:30 on an afternoon. And she does an amazing, I mean, she's like a certified YouTube educator, and she does a fantastic job of conveying complex ideas to children, okay? But, and she's friendly, she's warm, she's engaging, but at no time does she feel like she's slightly patronizing. And I don't think that Jodie Whittaker is intentionally patronizing, but there's something with the tone that when she's explaining, like when she explains at the end of the episode about Nikola Tesla, it just feels to me, it's just missing being where I'm just not buying it, even though I know it's true. Do you know what I mean?
But is that a danger in perhaps how we are brought up with women and men, that there is there's more of a diversity of how men explain, and it doesn't seem weird, but with women, because we don't see that as much in these sort of contexts. Limited down, because automatically you've sort of said that, you know, these women would be good to play the doctor, and it's sort of quite a sort of specific type of performance. While with the doctor as a man, we've had a multitude of very different ones, and we don't really. I'm not meaning this personally against you, Christian. I'm saying generally, we seem to, when we talk about doctors, we seem to sort of almost like gravitate to one sort of type of actress. And yet with men, because we see it in so many, because we're so much more used to seeing such a range of different acting styles and performances, we're a little more, I don't know, forgiving or flexible. I mean, I'm just thinking about it, because I don't find a patronizing.
Maybe patronizing is probably completely the wrong word. I'm just finding a lack of, I don't believe that she's that excited about stuff.
Okay, so that's interesting.
So I think that's where I'm probably coming from. I think I don't believe her. I'm not buying her enthusiasm about stuff. About meeting X and Y and Z or whatever. The actual adventure stuff, I'm buying all of that. But when the doctor's telling me how excited she is to meet so-and-so, or who so-and-so is, or what so-and-so goes on to do, it's not ringing true for me at all.
is that, but again, this is the same thing. I can't think of any characters like this Doctor I've really seen on television or film. And I'm not saying this is a brand new wave of stuff. I'm saying it's just something we don't see women characters do. And I genuinely can't. I can place this sort of speech with different men doing it, because men get to play these sort of overly enthusiastic, excited. I'm thinking I could see David Tennant doing this, those sort of speeches. You know, that's the sort of thing he would do.
Yeah, yeah. The thing is,
do you know what I mean?
Similar one in The Unicorn and the Wasp, and I don't particularly like that one either.
Well, and again, maybe that's again down to the speech as well. I'm trying to critique us as audiences, not either you or any type of person watching this, because there's times where I'm like, I don't know if I get that. And there's part of me which is very wary, because I seem to allow a lot of different diversities of absurd, outlandish male characters saying the same sort of thing. And there's a bit of me which is like going, is that just something to do with me, or is it something to do with the performance? And I'm not sure which it is. Mm. But I think
go on, Brian.
A writer, or rather an actor, is only as good as the material that they're given. Okay, that's the one thing we all have to remember. And you need to look no further than Patrick Stewart. And I'm sorry to say that, but he unfortunately took some jobs during his career before he was Captain Picard, and a little bit after being typecast, where it's not exactly the best written material. And he, as an actor, doesn't shine. And if Patrick Stewart, as an actor, doesn't shine, there's something wrong with the material that's in his hands. You know, I could say the same thing about Sam Jackson and a couple other great actors out there. So my thing is this, and it goes all the way back to Matt Smith, because I see similar issues with Jodie that I saw with Matt Smith, where they often will overplay the silly, or a lot of times are just doing silly things for the sake of doing silly things. Yet when they get given a proper moment to shine, there are times where I looked at Matt Smith and I said, please give me more of that. You know, I always go back to the terrible episode, Dinosaurs on a Spaceship, when he is talking to Solomon, fixing his legs. Never has he been a better doctor than in that scene right there. And he gets those scenes few and far between. And I feel that Jodie is the same way. I feel they're trying to write the silly. I feel they're overwriting certain scenes, because when they're doing the preachy things like they did last episode with us destroying the world with our, global warming and so on, I felt that they overwrote those things. And it's very difficult as an actor to kind of emote those scenes because they're overwritten. And I don't think even David Tennant could have saved one of those speeches. So for me, it has a lot to do with the writing. And we know Jodie is a very talented actress. We've seen many of her other works where we can see her range and we can see her depth and scope as a serious actor. Not just on the silly end of the panto scale of things. I think the writing is a huge part of it. And I think they really kind of need to dial back these messages that they're trying to convey, because they can be conveyed in a great way, but they're going over the top because they're trying to write a speech that they think is going to be remembered, that it's going to be the Ark in Space, Tom Baker's speech about humanity. They're all trying to rewrite that speech. And I don't think they're nailing it.
No, definitely. I mean, going back to what we were saying before, I think if you watch Maddie Moat, she's like about 30. She's just engaging in a way that the Doctor isn't, and maybe the Doctor should be in these situations.
Because it could be how, if what Brian is saying is correct, it could be about how they write the Doctor. And again, I don't want to keep making about gender. It could be how, when they're trying to articulate how they would think a female doctor would be, they think a female doctor would be sort of almost like teachy, and it's sort of, maybe it's the way they are. I don't know. It does infuriate me, because I think like the first two episodes of this season, the balance on her was a lot better, that it was not that she was able to do a bit of darkness. It kind of feels, and they did this with, actually, to be fair, they did this with Capaldi as well. I think what they're doing with Jodie is what they did with Capaldi, and they sort of try almost like they're trying to write that sort of Tom Baker over enthusiasm, as if that is what the Doctor always has to be, and the actor doesn't always fit with that. And I think
I don't remember much over enthusiasm from Tom Baker, to be honest.
But there seems to be that sort of larger than life. Okay,
David Tennant, maybe.
But then David Tennant was playing that same. I always felt with David Tennant, again, it was like this riff of what Tom Baker sort of holistically was like, rather than what he was like, because he's different, you know, different times of his era.
Yeah.
As if, you know, this overconfident, eccentric, larger than lifeness, I think is what I'm after. And they tried it with McCoy early on, and that didn't really fit with who McCoy was, and they toned that back. Same with Smith. So said, I think Smith got better when they toned it back from him.
But they only toned it back with Smith for a little while. It was never for a long period. And, you know, I say that because I tried to like every episode the man was in, and I couldn't, because his acting was always, it felt to me like Moffat always wrote him over the top because he knew that Smith liked to act over the top. And Smith thought that Moffat liked that he wanted him to be over the top. So he would write that over the top script even more over the top, acted even more. And that's been a big issue of mine, because I feel that there's a huge difference here is that everybody looks at Tom Baker or even Patrick Troughton as like the perfect type of doctor, where they have that silliness, that quirkiness to them. But what they miss is that with Patrick Troughton, his doctor often did those silly, quirky things to try and offset people, to make them think that he wasn't a genius and he could put seriousness behind it. Tom Baker, he sat there. Tom Baker changed, as we all know, he changed his entire life. Out in public, he didn't smoke, he didn't drink, because he thought children might see him. And when he was on screen, and he said this multiple times, he said that if something was supposed to be terrifying on screen, I had to show that I was terrified too. And then this way the audience would realize this is a bad situation. But then I had to also find a way to quickly turn it around and show them that I was still in control and I was still in charge because I'm the doctor. And I don't think we're getting that. And I think Matt Smith and Jody are two perfect examples of that, because I think they're just writing them going, well, the doctor's supposed to be silly, right? And writing them silly, and then trying to do serious things with them as well. But the switch doesn't quite click over the same way that it did with Tom Baker, because Tom knew how he had to dial himself down and bring things in and show, okay, look, I am a serious person. I like to have fun, but you've just pulled on that string you should not have pulled on. I'm not getting that with Jody in the same way that I wasn't getting that with Matt Smith. And again, it could be due to the acting or the writing, but I think it could also be a bit of a Capaldi situation, like you were saying, where with Capaldi, per episode, they kept writing him as the doctor they needed him to be per episode. But I'm wondering if they're doing that per scene with Jody, because when she bursts in the beginning of this episode, I thought she's being too silly there. Like there's something serious going on. And I just thought that's way too silly. I get the silly openings like that, but maybe they should have put it before the theme song then, you know, I don't know. It just didn't seem to gel.
It did feel like the theme tune should have come in at that moment. Let's hit Facebook.
Yeah, I agree.
Let's hit Facebook. So again, thanks to everyone who's commented. We appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts. I'll dip in and do a couple. Nick Caulfield, a lot of fun. I knew about Tesla and Edison anyway, and forget that most people probably still don't, apart from the names of the cars. Didn't know there's an Edison mobile. Bit of Vincent and the Doctor at the end. I think Vincent and the Doctor did it better. Quite like the idea of a monster that made out it was fierce with stolen tech that it couldn't maintain itself. Yeah. Andy Walker liked the fact Team TARDIS were mid-adventure, a bit like as I observed earlier. Soundtrack for the Doctor, Yaz and Dorothy, Tesla Girls by Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark. Nice. And Katie Poole says much less of a mess than last week and on safe, even well trodden ground. The human form bodies were genuinely disturbing, and I liked that it didn't shy from killing the scientist who had managed to duck under the table. Yeah, that was good. A slight shame they didn't make the Scorpion Queen more distinct in design from the Rachnos, and they struggled to find the companions enough to do. But other than that, I thought it was a sound middle of the road episode. I liked the voice that they gave the Empress. It was reminded me of female Eldrad.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So I particularly enjoyed that. I've forgotten about that. Nigel Webb declares this one of the best Doctor Who episodes ever made, a beautiful thing, and without doubt the best bigger on the inside description in 55 years of Doctor Who history. Goran and Jodie were so good together. Why can't we have a famous person from history as a companion? I wouldn't agree with that entire comment, but the final sentiment, certainly. Jonathan Roberts enjoyed the episode despite the Rachnos light aliens. David Madeley, far too much talking. That's not a review, it's just an observation. No, it's a review. Trevor Arthur observed bits to like, Red Eyed Zombies and Green Ping Pong Balls. Felt it was a bit predictable, which it probably was a bit. There's a slight templateness to episodes like this, isn't there? These days.
Yeah.
Which you don't so much get in the... Yeah, the comic strips have been guilty of being a bit templatey in the past, but I was thinking more, you don't get that really with Big Finish, do you? Big Finish takes the opportunity of the medium better than maybe television does, I feel.
I would definitely agree with that, but I would also think this particular episode, I didn't feel the template too heavy with it, or that it was too out of place. Like, it seemed to work. You know, mm-hmm. But I would definitely agree that Big Finish does break the mold a bit more, which maybe the TV show needs to do.
It did do a lot of things that we were complaining about last week, right? For instance, because there was no prologue of them coming to the place, it meant that they could get right into the story and do everything they needed to do, rather than feel like, there's bits missing because there's just no space. So at least it felt... If it didn't feel like amazingly mind-blowing or twisty, at least it felt like it was confident and it did everything it needed. I didn't think there was anything there that it really missed. The only thing I think it missed was the transition from them escaping to them being on the train was a little jarring. That just felt like it needed something in between to make that transition. But beyond
that was weirdly jarring for me. And I don't like, this is not even huge criticism, but the end of the episode, I shouldn't say finally, but it made me realize that, like, unless you're doing a cliffhanger, showing the characters just like mildly walk away and then throw in the end stinger of the end credits music just doesn't work. Like, when it ended, I was like, ooh, that was the end. Like, it was really weird that it wasn't a cliffhanger, or that it just didn't have some kind of like grand, the TARDIS is flying away thing or something. I just felt like they were like, all right, well, let's go. And I'm like, whoa. It was so weird. I just remembered that last night watching it going, I've never felt that before. But that was very odd.
And do you want to sound boring on this as well? We sound boring, I think, to most people who would never listen to this, let alone, and those who probably do. But I kind of feel that, well, it's because we've said this many times, this whole thing about the TARDIS being able to go wherever they want. I think the sad things about that is if you had an episode like this and it was not going wherever they wanted, and you have them appear in the middle of the story and they're sort of, you know, she can be doing exactly the same sort of thing, following some form of tracing, some energy sources, but the others are still very much of a sort of like trying to fit in, rather than this sort of almost like superhero-esque element that we've had for the last 15 years of whenever they do appear in the middle of things, they are intended to be there for whatever reason, that they are in control to some degree. And everyone, I think what gets me with that is it gives a hierarchy, that those who are visitors to that world are somehow better than that world because they know everything that's going on. And they're sort of almost like, I don't know, like backpackers going to an undeveloped country, that somehow they're superior because they come from a different place and they know what's going on. Do you know what I mean? If they're actually there because they don't want to be there, they're there because they're having to be there, that puts them in a position of feeling a little less in control, a little less powerful, and maybe a little more vulnerable than this whole thing that we do love in our history time travel shows, that the visitors to that time are somehow better than that time because they know more, and the rest of those time, the people in that time are always constantly going, how do you know all this? Where do you come from? A better
option would be, I think, to show that yes, they know more in terms of how the era turned out and what's coming next, but they don't actually know piss all about.
Yeah, absolutely.
Era. Yeah,
exactly. I think that's really important, and I know what I'm saying doesn't really necessarily relate to that specifically, but I think it's about rethinking why people are in that, why they're there, how they're in that era, what their motivations, how does that affect their ability to work, how dysfunctional is it? As you say, they do not know that era. How do we try and make it that they are visitors to a world that they do not know, rather than being sort of like gods to a world that does not know them? It's a weird thing, and I just think that would, I don't know, get away from the formula a bit and sort of create its own little jeopardy as well, and give a bit of feeling that the people, when you're the people of that time, have more power than just being sort of weird locals who don't understand the amazing technologies that we know now. That really gets me in time travel stories, and it's getting me more and more. And I think we need to be trying to find ways to break that down and, as you say, get away from it.
But you know, I also wonder why at the end of last week's episode, they got the grand speech, you know, if you don't take care of your world's going to end up just like we saw there. And they all were like, yeah, okay, cool. Where are we going next? Nikola Tesla? Awesome. Rather than take me back to Earth, I have to help change things for my own planet right now. it's a little, that's where the message, that's why last week's episode really should have been a different planet. Cause like you can then at least walk away and go, well, we don't know if we're leading there yet, but I've got time before you take me home that I can go feel like I can help sort this problem out.
Yeah. So I don't know. That's a fair point.
Yeah, similar absolutely. Kind of thought anyway.
If you suddenly, I never really thought of it like that. As soon as you create such a massive monumental truth to people's home, are they just going to want to go on another exciting adventure? Are they going to be like, we need to sort this. We need to sort this now. How do we sort this, Doctor? How do we change things from coming like that? You know, that's a massive, terrifying revelation, which they've got over very quickly. But then they get over most people's deaths, don't they, very quickly? You know, science under the table, you know, whatever. We'll just stroll off at the end of this episode because we're fine and we're just wandering through this other person's realm. And these people aren't half as important as us. It just has that kind of feeling. And I don't know, it just feels really Western that way. You know, very British, or maybe it is very British. It is the British colonial attitude, isn't it, almost? It's as if we somehow are more important.
I will say this, too. There was about this episode, it did one of the things that you would hope an episode about a historical character would do, which was kind of educate me a little bit further on Nikola Tesla. And, like, obviously, I've known quite a bit of his work. I'm one who actually has known him, unlike how Graham and Ryan and so on didn't know anything. But I wasn't aware of these claims of having a message from Mars. And when I looked into it further, it was the media who first speculated that it was a message from Mars and that he was saying that. But it was actually Tesla had said he didn't specify. He didn't know if it was Mars. It could be Mars or Venus or some other planet. So he did specifically say that it was potentially another planet, but like he wasn't the one to first put out there Mars. But I didn't realize that was a real thing. And I found that interesting. And it's kind of odd, especially in the circles that we kind of are in, to not have heard that a historical figure out there once believed that they made a communication with another planet. So I like that. I like that it did, and I'm sure that it did more for other people who weren't really up on Nikola Tesla, but I think it did its job there in not only saying this person is historical and this is what they did, kind of like the Rosa Parks episode. You know, it did a really great job in highlighting the significance of their role in history.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. So we're going to wrap that up for this week's podcast with Kate. A big thank you to James and Brian for joining us this week. And thanks to you, dear listener, and to the people on Facebook who've taken the time to leave their thoughts on Nikola Tesla's Night of Terror, a title which I feel would not be out of place in the discography of Alice Cooper. Until next time, it's goodbye from us.
This is a Beyond Casterbrus podcast. Available on iTunes, Audioboom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbrus.com.